How many of you like reading the Old Testament? Feel put, yeah, portions, right? Feel put on the spot a little bit there. So some portions are more interesting than others. I mean, and the portions we find interesting will probably differ from person to person, actually. Some parts are really confusing. I really enjoy Old Testament narrative in particular, and I expect a lot of you do as well. And I think that's because we're built for stories, actually. We're designed for stories. We communicate in stories. We're used to thinking about, we're kind of trained, even in some of the settings where we talk about biblical interpretation, we're trained to look for propositions, as though everything is a Pauline epistle. And as though actually we haven't read all that many of Paul's epistles. We're trained to look for propositions, but most of what we're given in the Old Testament and the New is actually in the form of story. So, I visited with Mike and thought what we might do for CE for the next little while is actually talk about how to read Old Testament narrative well. We could do that in a sense that's kind of abstracted from any particular text and gets very theoretical and uses those terms you might remember from a high school or a college literature class where if you didn't fall asleep, right? But we could also do that by working our way through a particular text with some of that reflection on what we're doing and why we're doing it and how we do it. But also in a way that helps us read a particular narrative. And so I thought we'd do that with 1 Samuel this semester. So I thought I'd take today, because we have no warning, right? No one's had a chance to sit down and start reading 1 Samuel yet. If you started a Bible reading plan this week, right, that's probably not where your plan started, although it might be a good place to start, actually. A friend of mine, we went to seminary together. He pastors now. He recommended to his parishioners, if you're going to start a new habit of reading the Bible regularly this year, why not pick a book that is easier to read to help build that habit, right? Get you some momentum as you're going. So if you haven't already picked a plan that's going to land you in Exodus here in a couple of weeks, you might just start with Samuel and go with us. So some general comments about, this is weird, how to read Old Testament narrative well. Part of it is just remembering it's narrative, right? These are stories. We're used to stories, right? What happens, well, think about it this way. Some of us read, and some of us really enjoy reading. Some of us like to watch shows, right? And those shows are a form of narrative, right? Some of us enjoy movies. Some of us enjoy telling stories or hearing others tell stories. One of the things that seems like it would be obvious and is when someone says so, but is less obvious when we sit down and pick up our Bibles, is that all of the resources, all of the strategies, all of the tricks that are part of telling stories well are at the disposal of and used by the biblical authors. So what are some of the things that that might include? What are some of the tricks of the trade of good storytelling that you think of as you think about shows you like to watch or books you enjoyed reading, or maybe things you didn't enjoy because they use them in a jarring way? One thing I'll put out there to get us started is how to phrase it, not telling the story in sequence, right? Some of the stories that we hear or read or watch, they start in the middle, right? Or something happens and then they back up to tell you what happened before. And I think that's definitely something that the biblical authors do. And some of the places where we get confused or we have lots of arguments, right, and hundreds of pages are written about a couple of paragraphs, often I think come down to we've failed to recognize that this thing that happens on our Tuesday night show that never bothers us, sometimes because, you know, there's 48 hours earlier. When it happens in the biblical text, right, we're thrown. We don't recognize what's going on. So, what are other things that are parts of good storytelling that you think of or you're used to seeing? Yeah. Yeah.
Like them or dislike the bad guy, like the good guy, that tends to draw me in more.
So characters, and there's so much there because there are different kinds of characters in stories, right? There are characters that, you know, we see them for 30 seconds. They're like an extra. They're a part of the scenery. There are characters that are involved and they do things, but they don't change. There are characters that undergo some kind of tremendous transformation over the course of the story. And we're used to seeing those kinds of things. Sometimes we recognize when an author doesn't do that well in some of those movies or some of those books. Yeah. And that becomes really, really important in Old Testament narrative, especially, I'll give you a peek at where we're going. It's extremely rare. It does happen, but it's extremely rare that the narrator in Hebrew narrative will actually step out from behind the story to say, this is a bad person. They'll usually do that. They'll give you that information by how they describe the character in their actions. So, yes, Jody.
And the other one relates to what you said. I like to know, I like the good and evil themes to be clear.
Yeah. Yeah, or even to take a step back from something that's so, has more on the line, even just resolution. Resolution. We're especially interested in justice, but even in small-scale stories that seem, you know, trivial in terms of these grand concerns, we want resolution. So just to catch us up on the recording, we've mentioned relationships, like relationships between characters and how those unfold or interact or develop over the course of a narrative, clear themes of good and evil and how those are played on, how they develop, and then a concern for justice. We want to see justice done. We want to see justice carried out. We're bothered when justice is thwarted. And then stepping back from that a little bit, narrative usually involves tension. There's something that's gone wrong or something that needs to be fixed. And that's kind of what drives the plot. And so we're looking for resolution as we read the narrative. So if you've just stepped in, we're talking about how to read Old Testament narrative well. And so from that, we're reflecting on what are some of the elements or the tools in a storyteller's toolbox, whether they're telling a story over dinner or whether you're reading a book or whether you're watching a movie or a TV show, and reflecting on how, because those tools are also at the disposal of the Old Testament authors. So
it seems like they tend to certain imagery.
Imagery, yeah. Yeah, so part of that, the imagery that's used and the assumption that you get it also involves backstory, right? If you walk into a movie 45 minutes in, there will be things going on that you don't understand, right? Or if there's a show that run 6 or 7 seasons and you try and start in season 2, there will be things that you don't get until you've kind of gone back and picked up what happened earlier. Right, yeah. So aside from just the backstory and the imagery, there's this cultural background. The assumptions of the intended readers, so to speak. Yeah. So one place we see that in Old Testament narrative, for instance, is what's the deal with the shoe? Right? When Boaz interacts with his kinsmen to redeem Ruth and Naomi and the land, right? What's the deal with the shoe? Why is that important? Right? That's just kind of weird. So, and then another example of the backstory, right? If we're reading Genesis and we get to the Joseph narrative, right? We start at chapter 37 and we plow through. Chapter 38 is really out of place, right? It's weird. It's about Tamar and stuff happens with Judah. And it's like, probably a 20-year, maybe not 20, but at least 10 years described in this one chapter that seems to distract us from what's going on with Joseph in Egypt, right? But when we get to the second trip down to Egypt, and Judah stands up and wants to put himself in Benjamin's place, right? That's bringing several of these things together. If we don't have chapter 38, we have no explanation for this dramatic change in Judah's character, where he suddenly moved from being in a position of just kind of going along with what his older brothers want to do to now taking this role of a leader who is willing to sacrifice himself for his family. That's another thing that we see in good storytelling. Two things: foreshadowing and the importance of detail. Right. Sometimes detail is there for the sake of detail. And sometimes we really, really enjoy that about a writer, and sometimes we really, really hate it. I know some of you probably really enjoy Charles Dickens. I'm sorry, I'm going to offend some of you. I feel like when I pick up Charles Dickens and I try to read him, I can tell that he was paid by the word. I've tried several times to start A Tale of Two Cities, right? And the Dover Mail is on the road, right? And you get two paragraphs describing the fog. And then it starts describing the coach. And then it goes back to describing the fog. And I get that the fog is really thick and they can't tell who's coming. And maybe it's even so thick that it muffles sound a little bit. But I'm ready to move on for the sake of the story, right? The rest of the details about the fog seem completely unnecessary, right? He could have said 3 paragraphs in 2 or 3 sentences, right? I feel like we would be better served if Dickens wrote the way Hemingway did. But anyway. One thing we'll find in Old Testament narrative is it's actually very sparse on detail. You don't believe me, right? Because we're going through Exodus, where we get all of these chapters on the instructions for the building of the tabernacle. And then we get that moment where it looks like everything's derailed. And then we get the actual building of the tabernacle that just revels in the details, because it's a celebration that this thing God said we would do that it looked like was off the table is actually being done. And there's so much detail there. But in general, Hebrew narrative is very, very sparse on detail, which means the details are very, very important. Where someone is from becomes really, really important. And we'll see that later. If you remember things we've done recently in Judges, right? Where do we end in the book of Judges? There's no king. Everyone does what's right in their own eyes. But where geographically do things go down at the end of Judges? This will be important as we get into Samuel. Gibeah and Benjamin.
I was going to mention geography.
Yeah.
So in Old Testament narrative and lots of the other kinds of stories we read, geography, place, is very important. Where things happen, where people are from, where someone is going, all of those things become very important, especially because the Old Testament happens in a specific place. And even though the scope of the Old Testament is, right, even if we just go from Abraham to the return from exile, right, we're looking at a millennium and a half, roughly. And in that time period, so much happens. And even so, the geographical scope of those things is fairly limited. From Egypt to Babylon, right, with most of it happening in Palestine, which means when it's noted that something happens at Jericho, part of the backstory and part of the detail and part of the cultural assumptions are what else happened at Jericho? When something goes down at Shechem, it may be mentioned that it's at Shechem because it wants you to think on, oh, what else happened at Shechem, right? Why is Shechem important? So on that note, who has a Bible with a map? Tony. Tony has a question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So attention to names, names of people, names of places, and knowing the variety of names that something can have that refer to the same place. Is it okay if I erase this? Yeah. Okay. Nobody on the recording is going to mind. I'll draw us a quick map of Palestine, and it's going to be terrible. Very, very terrible. But here's Asia Minor. There's the Levant. There's the way down to Egypt, which we don't want to go. That's bad. We have two big bodies of water and a river that joins them, right? So we have the Sea of Galilee, or the Sea of Tiberias, or the Sea of Chinnereth, depending on who we're reading when. The Jordan River flows down, and then we have the Dead Sea. And I've put that too far south. That's more like it. So the Jordan joins them, right? And the Promised Land is mostly on the left hand, or the west side of Jordan, between Jordan and the great sea, right? And this is not the scale. This is much smaller. Later in its history, right, Israel is going to be the name the northern kingdom takes. And then Judah will be to the south. And the tribe of Benjamin and the city of Jerusalem lie essentially right on the border. Israel's neighbors to the east spell the word same as we go from north to south. The Syrians, the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites. The Edomites are essentially southeast of the Dead Sea, all the way up to the Dead Sea, right? Ammon and Moab are descendants of Lot, Abram's brother. And then the global superpowers that surround Israel are further away. We've got Egypt down here. That's brown for desert. We got the Tigris and Euphrates that I'm not even going to pretend are drawn accurately, but they're over there. And Assyria is in the northern part of Mesopotamia, and Babylon is in the south. There are others around in the neighborhood. They don't matter for 1 Samuel, right? But we have the Hittites up here in modern-day Turkey, although they've been up and down the Levant all the time. And then we have Persia, which is east of Babylon, right? And the Greeks over here, which are not going to concern us for a long time, right? But that gives you a rough idea of where they're situated in relation to their neighbors. And as you can see, because of the desert, right, and especially because there are mountains here. So this is the main way to get from anywhere else down to Egypt, or for Egypt and Egypt's armies to get anywhere. They can move on the sea, but all of these armies prefer to move by land, and so they're always marching back and forth through Israel and Judah. The Philistines show up along the coast here, and they are what other ancient peoples call the sea people, or the Phoenicians, and they actually end up all over the Mediterranean. So we're used to seeing them in interaction with Israel and Judah in their early history, but they're actually involved all around the Mediterranean, including Carthage, right? So they interact with the Romans. And they're like all along there. So, and they will be the primary problem for Israel and Judah during the time of the Judges, moving into the reign of David. And then they kind of don't seem to be a problem as much as we move into Solomon and the Book of Kings. So. One of the questions we haven't talked about that hangs over Old Testament narrative in particular. Maybe we have too much time to get into this question. Is the problem of history? is what we read in historical narrative, in the Old Testament in particular, true? Is the history that we read in the Old Testament true? This is Sunday school, so someone's going to give me a Sunday school answer, right? So yes, of course it is. And I wouldn't disagree, but yes, so in terms of archaeology, right, can we substantiate the claims the Old Testament makes about history, who lived where, when, who ruled, for how long, with which peoples did they interact? Some of that has been substantiated by archaeology. Some of that seems to be possibly called into question by archaeology, and a lot of it we don't have any evidence. So should that be a cause of concern? Should we just ignore it? Should we not worry about it and just read it for the sake of the literature anyway? So there is a standard of evidence to which the Old Testament in particular is held that other ancient literature is not held to. There's a fascinating article by a fellow named Hans Barstad. This may not interest any of you, but I'll write it down anyway. I remember right, he's a Dane. He's part of what's called the Copenhagen School. This is a circle of extreme skeptics. So these are people who study Old Testament history and ancient history generally. And he's one of these guys, and he's extremely skeptical about any historical claims the Old Testament makes. But he wrote an article, which he presented as a paper to his friends and other people who were there, called The Strange Fear of the Bible, where he takes them to task for exactly that. He says, by all means, let's be skeptical. But you, my friends, are being dishonest and disingenuous. You are being more skeptical of the Hebrew Bible than you are of any other ancient literature. And that's bad scholarship. It's very interesting. He might say no. None of this history is true, but he recognizes that among certain circles of scholars, there's actually a deep bias against Old Testament history. Hans Barstad, The Strange Fear of the Bible. If you're interested in reading it, I can send you a PDF. I think it's actually a bad question. Is it true? And it's a bad question for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons it's a bad question is because you're going to have an immediate and not particularly thoughtful answer, whichever side of the discussion you're on. If you're skeptical of Old Testament history, you're going to say, of course not, except occasionally, coincidentally, right? And from the other side, you're going to say, well, of course it is, right? Without stopping to think about why someone would ask that question, or why someone would disagree. Has anyone seen Dragnet? Like the old episodes of Dragnet, right? I can't remember the name of the character. I can see his face, right? But what does he tell a witness anytime he's talking to them? Just the facts, man. Just the facts. Joe Friday. Thank you. Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am. Do we get just the facts in Old Testament narrative? Ooh, perspective. I like that word. That's a dangerous word. Are you sure you want?
Concentrated on one small area of the world.
So there's a sense in which the scope of Old Testament history, by its very nature, gives us a very limited perspective. So I think part of the difficulty we have in engaging this question is we come from a background of just the facts. And coming out of the Enlightenment, even though in a sense we're so far removed from the Enlightenment, and we would be critical of a lot of Enlightenment thought, we still have, as part of the foundation of our thinking, this assumption that we can get to just the facts. I'm going to sound like an extreme postmodern here, and maybe I am. I don't know. I don't think so. But of course, if I am, I'm probably not aware of it. But what we have in Old Testament narrative is interpreted history. And so one thing we can do is we can make a distinction between history as event and history as account. And one word we might use for the latter is historiography, history writing. We don't get just the facts. We get story. Story that tells us things. Story that tells us about people. Story that tells us about God's interaction with his people. And if we read it carefully, it helps us uncover why those things are important. And I think part of what's gone awry in Old Testament interpretation is an interest in just the facts. And a coming to the Old Testament and finding that what we have is not just the facts. And a reaction to that, that, oh, this must mean that this is biased and skewed in such a way that it cannot be trusted. And so our best options are to kind of discard the fluff so that we can get at the facts and try and reconstruct what the facts are. Or just set all of this aside. Right, and find other means to try and get at the facts. And so for better than 100 years, maybe close to 200, from the early 19th century well into the 20th, there was a concern, an overwhelming concern in Old Testament studies, not for understanding and interpreting the literature well, but using the literature as a means, or kind of removing the literature as a hindrance to reconstruct the history of events in Palestine from as early as we can up until the exile and later. I think actually a recognition that that's not what the literature is doing and not what it is designed to do helps us avoid certain pitfalls and helps us read Old Testament narrative better. Part of what would keep us from going down this path in the first place, and part of what was so frustrating to scholars who were interested in trying to reconstruct the history, actually, is that we have both Kings and Chronicles. Right? If you look at the book of Kings, it begins with the transition to the reign of Solomon. It goes all the way up to partway into exile and tells that history. It tells that history inclusive of both kingdoms and the kind of the summary point of that history is we departed from the law as it's given to us in Deuteronomy, especially in following our leaders. And that, by the way, is why we are in exile. Our leaders broke the covenant. We followed them in doing so, and now look at the mess we're in. Chronicles covers largely the same history, although it uses the genealogies. If you notice, in those first 9 chapters, it starts with Adam. All the way up to chapter 9, it picks up with the death of Saul and then slows down. It recounts in great detail David and then Solomon. And then it covers the history of the southern kingdom, but all the way up to Cyrus's edict. So that it ends with this proclamation from the edict of Cyrus, inviting people to go up and return. So it tells the same history with different selections, and with the point being, come home, rebuild the temple, follow the house of David, right? And let us worship as God intended. So you have two substantial blocks of material that recount the same historical events with different principles of selection and with different points being made. So if we're trying to reconstruct the facts, that's very, very frustrating, right? But if we're trying to learn how to read the narrative well and see what the narrator is doing with something, that's beautiful and enriching and also challenging. Because we have to rise up to recognize what's going on and read that well. This happens with New Testament as well, right? How many Gospels do we have? 4, right? But we have this thing. We have this genre of literature called a gospel harmony, right? Where people will sit down with all 4 Gospels before them and then try and set things, everything that happened in the life of Jesus in the order it happened, right? And that can be really, really helpful as you read these parallel passages next to each other and see how different authors have crafted the story of Jesus in certain ways, right? In accord with the themes that they're highlighting in their gospel. But it can also kind of flatten the richness that we have. And that's actually a very, very early, right? A lot of these things we kind of lay at the feet of historical criticism, German higher criticism of the 19th century, as though everything is the fault of those Germans, right? But Tatian, in the 3rd century, is the first example we have of this, Tatian's Diatessaron, where he assembles 1 mega gospel from the 4 gospels. It's the first example we have of a gospel harmony where he tries to flatten it all into 1 text, right? Which can be really helpful, but loses the artistry of the individual portraits that each gospel writer draws. So, to back up a bit, does the Old Testament give us history? Yes. Is that history true and reliable? Yes, but that history is also interpreted, right? It doesn't give us that so that we can draw a timeline. It gives us that so that we can understand God's ways with his people and how we fit into that. It's grounded in history, and that is extremely important. These things that God did were with real people in real places in real time. It's not unanchored from history. But the important thing is not to be able to put things in order on a chart or to know exactly who was reigning at what point and for how many years, although we get a lot of those details. Right? The point is to understand God's actions with his people in that history. So, Dwayne.
Necessarily, and what would it be?
Yeah.
That's not what it's intended to be.
So yeah.
To say that, you know, only certain things are, you know, recorded in that history, and that's true of every single history ever.
Yeah.
It's also true that many histories are just from the, you know, it's whoever won got to write the history.
So I love to quote that, actually, from the prologue of Braveheart, right? History is written by those who have hanged heroes. So yes, all history writing is selective by its very nature, right? That history writing is also, even when it doesn't expressly acknowledge it, all history writing is also interpretive. Even simply in the choice, the selections that are made. One way we can see this that's kind of removed from this question of Old Testament history and how the narrative works, if you look at descriptions or narratives of Pickett's charge, the Battle of Gettysburg, and if you contrast Shelby Foote's description of Pickett's charge in his The Civil War, a narrative, with Michael Shara's description of Pickett's charge in The Killer Angels. It's very interesting. Shelby Foote's a son of Mississippi, right? And he hadn't lived in Mississippi for some time, but you can tell as you read his description of Pickett's charge that this is like the last, this is the defining moment of Southern honor and glory. And it's beautiful, and it's kind of the, I can't find the words. It's the shining example of what it means to fight for glory and honor in war. And that's written by a son of Mississippi, right? If you read Michael Shara's account, it's a disastrous, avoidable result of the terrible management of several generals. And it's sad. And it's pathetic. But Pickett was so bound to duty that knowing all of this, he did it anyway. And they're both so powerful and so beautiful in their description, but the perspective from which they describe it is so very different. So very different. The same events, right? The same general understanding of what happened and why and who was involved, but very different portraits of what went down late that morning as they charged up that hill. So, I think we're over time already. There are a couple of books I wanted to recommend that I've found helpful along the way. Mike had a couple copies in his office. One is V. Phillips Long, The Art of Biblical History. It's really helpful for thinking through history writing and history writing in the Old Testament and what it's like and how to read it well. Then especially for narrative is Robert Alter, The Art of Biblical Narrative. I would read the last chapter first. The first 8 or so chapters are all the theory behind narrative and how it works. The last chapter is a case study in the stories of the patriarchs where all of that comes together. So if you read the first several chapters, it's really a slog, and you wonder why any of this matters. If you read the last chapter first, it's amazing, and you see how it works, and then that makes you interested in what he has to say in the earlier chapters. So I found that out the hard way by assigning this for a class and telling them after they'd started reading it, hey, you should read the last chapter first. There are others I would also recommend. I'll have a handout ready for us next week. So Yeah, if you would read the first chapter of Samuel, and we'll come back to this. Given the scope of Samuel and of Old Testament history in particular, the book of Samuel begins in a very interesting and unlikely place. I'll just leave it there. Ron.
Read the first chapter of the first book of Samuel.
Yes, so I refer to 1 and 2 Samuel as Samuel. It's one book. It's just too long to fit on one scroll.
Okay.
And so there's a not... It's deliberate about where it's divided, but I commonly refer to it as just Samuel. So I would read the first chapter of 1 Samuel. And more if you like.